Welcome to Formula Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
Cindy, why are you all excited today?
I am, because I love breakfast. I really do.
Right? I mean, breakfast
and
makes...
I love eggs. Eggs are
the best. The idea of waking up and having good breakfast.
God. Oh, my God. And especially if somebody else makes it for you. Isn't that like the greatest thing in the world? A fire going... In the wintertime, a fire going in the fireplace.
You see, I'm a more generous person. I would like to get up and make breakfast for people.
Uh-huh. So do I, but it's more fun when someone else makes it for you. I'm a chef.
Boy.
Of course I like making
breakfast.
But it's fun. I mean, nothing like a fire going in the morning and somebody making breakfast, coffee or tea or whatever it is going, and you can smell that. Oh, my gosh, that is the best home stuff. It also reminds you of holidays. You know, I mean, I think we really outdo ourselves typically with breakfast on holidays in this country because we, you know, families together, it's time to, you know, pull out all the punches. Cooking-wise.
Speaking of pulling out all the punches,
And tradition. A lot of breakfast. There's a lot of tradition to breakfast.
Going back to pulling out all the punches.
And regional influences, Tony. Lots of... Because I'm Southern today. I'm not saying anything French today. It's all...
Really?
All Southern. Concentration.
You don't like French breakfast?
I love French breakfast. Don't put words in my mouth, Foreman. But I just thought today was a good day to concentrate on our country and the South, because... We make some seriously good breakfast down south.
So for the third time, I'm going to try to go back to not pulling any punches.
Okay.
So I posted on social media a list of wines with a glass.
Okay.
Okay.
Basically asking
which would you like for your breakfast wine.
Oh, geez. Okay. Yeah.
One of the things about being in Europe that I greatly appreciate is the fact that breakfast often is laid out.
And includes wine.
Includes just a little bit of something light, simple.
Right.
It
should.
Something to balance, to aid the digestion, to...
Got it.
To brighten the mood.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, it used to
be
that way.
To make you realize you're in a civilized place.
Right. Well, it used to be that way in this country because I was reading Sarah Belk's book on Southern cooking this morning, and she was talking about how in the South it used to be that before they went out and checked the farm or the plantation or whatever, that the people, obviously I'm sure it was mostly men, would get up in the morning and would have a mint julep or a brandy to get the day started. And then they would head back up to the main house at 10 a.m. for breakfast.
I mean, how are you supposed
breakfast.
To get out of bed without a mint julep waiting for you on the tray?
Well, yeah, I guess. I don't know. Seems like a crazy way to get the day started to me, but... Back in the day, they didn't think about that being a negative thing, obviously.
It's
so it's
refreshing. I don't like
coffee. And apparently Europe hasn't changed from what you're saying, so that's pretty cool.
No, a lot of it has, but I mean the idea of, especially as a traveler or as hosting someone or, you know, it's nice. I mean, I think
a
the one
Prosecco
thing
Prosecco for breakfast.
Prosecco's low on alcohol.
It is, it's just fresh and light and crispy and
it just kind of
bubbly.
Cleans up that...
Your toothpaste.
That's horrible.
Not good.
No, you have to eat a piece of toast or something between the toothpaste
Prosecco.
And then the Prosecco. Breakfast is such a particularly positive thing. I want to do a breakfast psychology test on you, and I hope you don't mind the examination.
Well, since you're not qualified.
I'm going to say the word.
This ought to be interesting.
I am absolutely qualified to conduct this test.
In any way qualified.
I'm not qualified to do anything else besides driving the state of Maryland according to my license.
In the room with me, right? Go ahead.
It will not keep you safe.
Okay.
So I'm going to say the word, and
oh,
you're
going to
say the first word that pops into your mind.
I'm not sure I want to play this game. Go ahead.
Okay. Ready? Close your eyes, please.
No. Go ahead.
Come on. I'm not going to throw anything. Pancetta.
Browning. That's my answer. That's my final answer.
Okay.
Tony.
One word. Let's try again.
Sauté. Go ahead.
One word. Donut.
Whole.
God, what a downer.
Sugar glaze.
What a
happiness
downer.
Smile. That's what I see when I see
yeah,
donut.
Exactly.
Smile, yes.
Okay, waffle.
Oh, butter and sugar and happiness.
Yeah.
It's all happiness. And childhood memories.
Brioche.
Oh, eggs. Yummy. Good butter. Rich. Use it all the time. Yeah, it's a lot more than one word.
Yeah, you're like a breakfast
brioche.
Meat poet.
Brioches, I mean, with pancetta, I love pancetta because it gives off so much good fat. You're crazy. It's like you're not playing this
just
game
have no,
correctly.
No, you just have no control of yourself. You're giving great information, but you have no control of yourself.
Wait, what was the last thing? I forgot already.
I'll give you a new one.
Okay, good. Go ahead.
Scrapple.
Ew.
You're in Maryland.
I know, but...
You can't...
Okay, well, if it's made well, it's delicious. I made scrapple one day. Do you remember? It was really good. And my
dad is really good. My great-grandmother used to make scrapple.
Oh, God. I mean, actually, not ooh, because it can be made really, really well. And it obviously has cornmeal in it, which is interesting because, you know, my dad was still alive when I made it. So I asked him because he grew up in a butcher shop.
It's kind of crispy southern pate. I mean, it's really not
right,
that.
Right, right. One of the first things his responsibility when he was just a little boy was to stir the scrapple. Which was to basically stir the broth that they made from all the trimmings because it was a butcher shop. So obviously
the trimmings,
they were bringing
that's
in,
a very appropriate
well,
word.
Well, I didn't want to upset anybody. And, you know, and make a great, great stock from that or broth, whatever. It's really a broth. And then they would make the scrapple in that. And so that was one of my dad's first memories really of working in a butcher shop when he was probably, you know, 6 or 7 years old, which is pretty amazing. That's kind of cool. All right.
You ready?
I am.
Chocolate chip pancakes.
Oh, yeah. I don't understand why I'm supposed to only come up with one word. I can't play this
just
game,
just because
Tony.
I'm trying to torture you.
I just don't know. I mean, actually, when I see a chocolate chip pancake in my mind, I see little chocolates, pieces of chocolate made into the form of a smile. So that does seem to be our theme here,
oh
which is happiness
God.
And children. But if I was going to make chocolate chip pancakes...
Children, if your mother doesn't put the chocolate chips in the form of a smiley face, please, you should consider your mother's relationship with her.
I think that you should use Valrhona chocolate if you're going to do bits of chocolate in your pancakes. I mean, get really, really good chocolate. Because how often are you going to make them? Not that often.
Actually, I have a question for you. I'm not going to play the word game anymore.
Okay, good.
Okay?
That
because,
seems wise.
Because you broke it.
I broke the game.
You broke the game.
Yeah.
What is your favorite type of preserve?
Oh, gosh.
Whether for toast
black raspberry.
Or to put on pancakes.
I can give you, see now, I can give you one word. Black raspberry.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
This is a better game.
Yeah, this is better. That's smarter.
So black raspberry for all applications.
Oh, my gosh. I love black raspberries. Well, I've already said that probably 1,200,000 times. But I buy a jam. That's my favorite. And I like cherry preserves, too. You know, I'm not really into lemon preserves. I don't really want my preserve to be that acidic.
You mean like lemon curd?
Yeah, that doesn't. I don't really love lemon curd that much. I mean, to me, you can only use tiny, tiny, tiny bit. If I use black raspberry jam, man, there's a whole lot going on my English muffin or my piece of brioche or my whatever I'm putting it on, a biscuit. Oh, one of the things I can't wait to share later is I was going through Edna Lewis's book, who is one of the greatest Southern chefs that's ever lived. And she has a recipe in there, and I didn't realize it, for biscuits that only make 10 biscuits. So I'm going to give that recipe to you guys later because that is awesome. You know, obviously my recipe for biscuits, you know, makes like 150, and most commercial recipes do. And any recipe, obviously, that I've developed, I had to develop for the restaurant. So
wait a second. You think that people listening don't want to make 150 biscuits for breakfast tomorrow morning?
I think that might be too many.
Since you're talking about it,
Edna Lewis's.
Because we want to get into a few recipes. We're having a happy time with breakfast, but the point is to get into a few recipes and a few approaches.
Yeah. Well, so her small biscuit recipe, and I will say it says 8 to 10 minutes at 450 degrees, or 12, actually, I'm sorry, it says 12 to 13 minutes at 450 degrees. That seems very hot to me. So if you don't know the temperature...
You got to get good rise because that's going to get brown.
Yeah, so if you don't know the true temperature of your oven, make sure you have... Well, you should always have one in there anyway, an oven thermometer in there. Yeah, so I'm going to back it down to 400 because 450 seems really...
You better
really,
rotate it for hot spots,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that just seems really high to me. Actually, I would think maybe even 375, but... You could start at 400, see how your oven does, and make sure your oven is true at temperature. So it's half a pound of unbleached, obviously, all-purpose flour, half a teaspoon of salt, and I'm sure her recipe is, it doesn't say kosher, so I have a feeling that's iodized salt. So, you know, I would just say maybe a teaspoon of kosher salt, if that's what you use, which is what I use. 4 teaspoons of single-acting baking powder, 2 ounces of chilled lard, and 2/3 of a cup of milk. Now, one of the things about the chilled lard, obviously you could use butter if you prefer. Frankly, I have no other alternative for you. So either some sort of animal fat or butter. I have never made it with anything else, so that's all I can talk to you about.
And good with duck fat.
Right.
Have butter, have duck fat.
Oh, my
also
gosh.
Good.
Duck fat is so good. Yeah.
My great-grandmother used to make them with have butter, have duck fat.
Right. And or pork fat. which I would probably do only if I was certain to be serving some sort of pork product at breakfast. If I was going all sweet for breakfast, I would use butter, quite frankly. And lard, of course, is hard to find, quite frankly. So, but, you know, with the recipe, you can make it in a bowl and you don't have to get out your mixer. But if you want to get out your mixer, you mix all the dry ingredients in a bowl and then you put them in the mixer and then you put all the lard in. Do not put the milk in yet, and put all the lard in, and you just work it on low speed until it feels like sort of like a rough cornmeal texture. You just kind of want it to gently break up that fat into it, and it's just going to, like, yeah, look like kind of cornmeal-y. And then you add all the milk at once, mix it quickly, not on high speed, but maybe 3/4 of the way up on your mixer, and if you're using your mixer, and get it done and stop. And the moment it's incorporated, which should literally be like 30 seconds, the biggest thing with making biscuits is you do not want to overwork the dough. This is not something that you're working the glutens. You just want the glutens to do their job initially and then stop. So you really want to work quickly, delicately, and hardly do any work, really.
So you don't want to activate the glutens. You don't want to activate the
proteins.
You're
not trying to make baguette or batard or, you know, some really full-bodied bread. You're trying to make something that's light, almost like a cake.
The more you exercise the flour,
the more you activate the glutens. Yeah, and you make it have more bonds, which makes it tougher, which makes it stronger. Tougher, in this case, would be bad. So once you've made the dough, lightly dust your surface, your work surface with the same flour, and just put the dough out. Make sure your rolling pin is dry and clean, obviously, and then roll that out to maybe 3/4 of an inch. And have a fork ready and a biscuit cutter ready. And certainly if you don't have a true biscuit cutter, which you don't have to have, if you have just a set of circle cutters, you can use those. Just make sure they're sharp. I mean, the biggest thing with any kind of cutter is if you've had it for a long time and used it a lot, it's going to become dull, which is going to shred the sides of the dough. And you don't want that. And frankly, almost anything you're cutting, you don't want that.
If you don't have a cutter, if you have to use a knife and make squares, then make squares.
Sure, but, I mean, honestly, I'd suggest going out and buying a circle cutter. They don't cost very much. And also, there's so many things you could do with a set. You can buy single circle cutters. You can buy single biscuit cutters. But a whole set of, you know, say 10 circle cutters are really nice to have for different things. You can use them as molds as well as use them to cut. And
at
home,
you can count them, you can play with them.
Oh, geez. And then, so with that, then once you've rolled it out and cut them, and obviously, as Ms. Lewis says in the book, you want to put your cutter right next to the edge of the dough. You don't want to waste any of this dough because you don't want to rework that dough. You can, but you really don't want to. And then use a fork to just dock. You know, that means just poke each biscuit maybe 2 times, 3 times, depending on how big your biscuit is. And
so you don't get bubbles.
Right. And then I wash mine with eggs. I was surprised in her recipe in this instance that she didn't say to wash the top of the dough. So don't.
Because
she hasn't said to do it. So don't. Maybe with this recipe there's some reason.
You're going to have to explain what washing.
Oh, sorry. Egg wash, you would mix a whole egg with a little bit of water in a bowl, whisk it, and then use a pastry brush. And actually, if you do decide to maybe wash a couple of them just to make sure it comes out nicely that way, just to test it, use a dry pastry brush to just don't go crazy, but if you have excess flour on top of your dough, you want to kind of gently brush that off. If you don't feel like doing that, don't. If you're like, I don't know, I don't want to hurt the biscuit, then don't do it. But if you are confident with yourself, just brush any excess flour off and then wash it lightly, the whole top of the dough, just the top of the dough. You don't want to retard the sides from rising, which you do if you drop the egg wash on the sides. And maybe that's why she doesn't want you to do that or doesn't mention it.
She's trying to save you from yourself.
And if you do that, you can always sprinkle a little sugar on there too. So there's nothing wrong with that. I know.
Is that a Yankee?
I like it. No, that is definitely not a Yankee thing. I will say one thing that is interesting about, you know, I just did a tiny little bit of quick research on grits and hominy this morning. Just because, you know, I've been making grits for a long, you know, 25 years.
Let me, because I think grits are a whole
other. That's a big category.
That's a big topic.
Okay.
We just have a moment left. I want to know your top 5 things you wish to put in that biscuit.
Oh, gosh. Well, definitely cured ham. And I like a smoked ham as well. But I really like thinly sliced cured ham.
You mean like Smithfield ham?
Yeah, like Smithfield.
Or prosciutto
or
de Parma.
Or prosciutto or Iberico. I love Iberico ham so much. So, you know, if we're going to leave the United States and go to Spain, I would my first choice would be Iberico. And then,
I'll go to Spain.
Yeah, and I actually like Iberico ham better than I like prosciutto. I just like, I know, but that's me, so that's my personal choice.
I love them both.
And that is, I love them both. I'm not saying I don't, but I really, really love Iberico ham. Really good Iberico ham is just like mind-boggling good. I would definitely say a good preserve and butter. I like honey and butter, and I make my own brown sugar butter, which I typically make for my pancakes, but I would definitely put a tiny little bit of that inside of a biscuit. But in the end, to me, a biscuit... you know, you can do a million things to a biscuit. My goodness, you can make great sausage and great, you know, I'm not fond of the word gravy, but if you make it well, sausage gravy can be really, really...
No, I really know how to annoy you.
Really yummy. That biscuit is a great vessel for a lot of different things. Fresh fruit. Yeah, so...
Maybe a poached egg.
A poached egg, a scrambled egg, lots of things.
So we're talking about breakfast, breakfast food. Next segment will be all about grits. Third segment, save a little bit of time, Cindy, and energy for the Chef's Challenge that's coming your way.
You got it, Tony.
All of that and more on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine on WIPR. Welcome back to Formula Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
We're talking about breakfast. In the last segment, Cindy talked about Edna Lewis's biscuit recipe, as opposed to Cindy Wolf's biscuit recipe that feeds 150. Edna Lewis's is for 10.
Which is awesome.
We'll have that posted online on the Formal Wolf page on the WYPR website, or you can go back and listen to the podcast and hear Cindy explain it. Just go to the Formal Wolf page at the WYPR.org website and download this episode or any one of the others.
Tony, I think it's interesting. You know, the first hogs were brought from England to Jamestown, Virginia in 1608. How do you like that? Can you imagine? So, I mean, it was such a staple of the diet. That and, of course, the Native Americans introduced corn, you know, into the diet for the people coming over. And you know, those two things were just total staples for eastern United States.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine cooking without pork.
Yeah, I certainly can't imagine, but yes. Well, and
I mean, there's plenty
of
cooking without pork.
Right, right.
When you think about breakfast, it's a lot of times things are based on, I mean, my great-grandmother's is a ham steak in a pan.
Oh, yeah.
And biscuits.
Oh, we have to talk about ham steak in a pan.
You know, and like pickled pepper. The biscuit often would have like butter and pickled peppers.
Oh, pickled peppers. How fun is that?
Yeah.
Oh,
have that with your ham steak.
Well, that's a nice balance
and a fried egg on top of that guy.
Well, and also one of my other favorite things that's from like Andrew Jackson's time was, you know, and there's so many different stories because
just like the Whigs.
Oh yeah, things weren't recorded very well, and you know, his famous red eye gravy apparently came from one of his cooks, and you know, the story is either he said, "Well, I want, you know, gravy as red as your eyes, cook person," or the story is that the cook was hungover or still intoxicated and accidentally poured coffee in the pan where he was cooking the ham. So
I always thought if he wanted it for a hangover cure, which is what I always heard,
yeah,
that it wasn't smart. I don't want coffee for a hangover cure. I want a little bit, you know.
I want the fat.
I want a little bit of the snake that bit me. You know,
oh, there you go. The idea, though, and, you know, with everything that, as a chef that I've done with Southern cooking, is trying to figure out how to take something that is traditional and not alter it too much and yet make it, well, first of all, work in a restaurant, which... Since Southern food is food of the home, and particularly breakfast is obviously food of the home. You know, not too many people used to go out for breakfast. So these dishes were big dishes that were made for, you know, service pieces on buffets or in big bowls for the family on the table or whatever, no matter what your economic background was. And
so what is your red eye gravy these days?
Yeah, so my version.
And what would you use it for?
I've used it for venison, which, oh my goodness, the flavors go so well together. Since venison has such a beautiful you know, strong flavor, positively strong flavor, what we would do is if we seared the venison in the pan, deglaze that pan with chicken and veal stock, and, you know, to the point of being maybe 3/4 of the way to a reduction sauce consistency, and then add a little bit of espresso. So because, you know, you're in a restaurant, you've got this great espresso made, and easy for us to have the waiters run back, make an espresso, and then we've got that ready to go nice and fresh. Deglaze the pan with that, and then finish with a little bit of cold butter. And that terminology in French is monter au beurre. So you are lifting, literally lifting with butter, or thickening the sauce with cold butter that you do not allow to separate. So you've cooked this piece of venison. Maybe you even throw in a piece of ham of some sort, whether for us it's tasso ham or dice of, or brunois, which is the smallest of dice of a piece of country ham, or maybe you're serving a piece of prosciutto or iberico, or again, a thin slice of American cured ham on the plate with it as a garnish. Maybe you have a little dice of some too. Pop it in the pan, flavor that sauce, add that chicken and veal stock, add that tiny bit. And believe me, you don't need much espresso. You're talking like a table, maybe a teaspoon for one person, and then finish it with that cold butter. And then that's something you can serve with creamy grits. I mean, that's just like perfect. Or creamy polenta, or crispy polenta. Polenta that you make with water and salt, let it cool down, cut it into long pieces, fry it in oil, and then you've got this sort of fatty, wonderful thing to absorb that incredible sauce on the plate and to give fat to the venison that's super lean.
That's the whole time you're talking about that, I'm thinking about for breakfast. I don't know if I want a piece of venison, like a rare piece of venison, but I definitely would eat hash.
Yeah.
If cleaning that venison to cut those primaries, if you had little bits of trim left that you could combine with potato and onion and make a hash and then make that cool and then get it hot again so that you can get it nice and crispy on the outside.
Yummy.
Put a poached egg on that guy.
Oh, golly. Yeah.
And then a little bit of your red-eye gravy. then you got something. That for breakfast, I would want that.
Well, and also hash.
Let me have that on some kind of big hearty toast of some sort. And
it's funny you talked about hash because I was, again, that's another big Eastern seaboard kind of thing, whether it's in the South or in the North. It just differs with the ingredients that you had that were indigenous to your region. But hash is started from the word haché. H-A-C-H-E-R in French. Is that correct, Tony?
Haché.
And which means to chop in French. So that's where the whole thing comes from. So that's, you know, we think of it as being onions or potatoes from some day-old piece of meat that you chop up, that you want to utilize because, you know, you had roast beef yesterday and, oh, yeah,
it's not the primary cut or it's already
beef
cooked.
Or it's, yeah. And so that's fun. I was seeing a recipe for sweet potato hash. I'm like, oh, my goodness, that sounds so good. I never, ever thought to put sweet potatoes in instead of white potatoes, and that's so Southern to do that. And
sweet potato hash would make you want chilies in there.
Exactly. And then I started thinking about, poblano peppers, and maybe you could roast poblano peppers, or like you were talking about your grandmother's pickled peppers. Oh, that would be so good with something like that, where you're definitely, you know, talk about hangover food, man. That is super satisfying.
Really? Yeah, really good breakfast. Wait. I don't know that there's any particular magic to the cure, but a solid breakfast does improve the rest of your day. And if you're starting from a very low place,
maybe it brings you. It's that's funny.
It gets you out of the basement at least.
Right. Oh boy. Yep. Yeah.
You'd mentioned polenta.
Oh my goodness.
And grits both.
Love them.
So let's talk about that. That polenta, you know, is something that's very. Both are close to my heart.
Oh, yeah.
Polenta, I was just making a dish. I wanted to make a vegetarian dish for a restaurant menu on the weekend. And we took a little bit of a broth, whether it be mushroom or chicken or whatever, but with garlic and favas and farro in there.
Oh.
Okay.
Yum.
So you have your polenta. You garnish with a little bit of this business. You have a sauté of nice gathered mushrooms, forest mushrooms like maitakes or the hedgehogs or something along those lines.
Okay.
Half and half saute of that with rapini, with a little more garlic and a little chili.
Oh my God, that sounds so good.
Poached egg sits in the nest there with that juice, that broth around.
Good.
And then the rapini and the mushrooms on that guy.
That's nice.
And a little glass of, you know, something light and pretty, Chianti Colli Fiorentini or a white, a nice Trebbiano from Umbria or something. And
wonderful. It sounds like a very good.
There's a civil breakfast. Satisfying, not unhealthful.
Right, exactly. That's great. And, you know, I think that's
just have to have nice fresh polenta.
Sort of doing research, you know, a realization probably in the late 1800s, early 1900s, that what people were eating for breakfast really kind of hit people, and that it was too much, and that it was too fatty, and maybe wasn't the most healthy thing. And the idea, I want to get back to grits and polenta, but I do want to get this thought out, which is, yes.
Those meals were for people who are about to go and work in a very agricultural life.
Right, right. And then as things changed, particularly in the South, that menu definitely became less and a little bit more healthful. And also as citrus fruit became more available in this country, that also had a huge change on how breakfast was eaten. But getting back to grits and polenta, okay, so a lot of people will ask me, what's the difference between polenta, grits, and hominy? And hominy is the dried corn that's been treated with lye and the hull is removed. And grits are the hull with the germ and they're ground. So hominy is basically a whole corn kernel, and a lot of cultures, that is like if you're making empanadas from Colombia, then you're using that corn. You're cooking it for a long, long time until it's really tender, and then you're making your empanada dough with that. Empanadas are made in different ways in all countries, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and in the fillings are, you know, what's inside of them is different, like from family to family. So that's one of the things I just love about empanadas. I think they're so fascinating that there's just so much culinary history and personal history to that particular food. And I'm just so proud every time I make them, however I make them, because it reflects so many different people's cultures. But getting back to hominy grits, I was super excited when doing the research for a restaurant in D.C. where I first did Low Country Cooking, to find that someone that I used to work with, who is Glenn Roberts, he was the GM of the restaurant where I did my apprenticeship in Charleston, South Carolina when I was 19 years old, owns a company called Anson's Mill. And so I've been buying grits from him for, 28 years, whatever it is. And now over time, Glenn is just an absolute brilliant man. And he is so determined to preserve the pathways of Southern cooking, and was really a part of that whole movement when we opened, and the restaurant's called Georgia Brown in D.C. that you and I opened. And, Vidalia had opened just before we did, and that was in the early 90s, it was 93, and it was a time where, you know, Southern food was really becoming a food that was viable for fine dining restaurants. You know, we were all trying to figure out, how can we make this wonderful historic cuisine, how can we bring it to the table in a restaurant? So, and Glenn has just, you know, brought in he grows all these great agricultural products that he got seeds from Clemson University, from the seed banks, and from other sources, and has brought back, you know, like Petit Rouge peas that we serve, and Sea Island white rice peas, all these things that, I mean, we haven't had these things for over 100 years. So this kind of thing is so important to our country, our cooking culture.
Well, the Carolina Gold short grain rice.
Oh my gosh, that was incredible that they brought back the Carolina Gold rice, because that was the type of rice that was grown pre-Civil War. And, you know, I mean, that was the whole economy depended on rice, indigo, and cotton. So, I mean, it's just a huge part of the history of that region.
You can make risotto with that stuff.
You can. Yeah, right? Exactly. So grits are a super important thing. And the fact that Glenn also uses the heirloom variety corn that used to be grown in the South to make his grits, that was the next step in really authenticating, as well as the stone grinding process, authenticating the way that grits used to be made. And so with grits, it's four parts liquid to one part product.
What do you make your grits with?
I make my grits with milk, a tiny bit of salt, and literally, like if I'm making 4 cups of grits, I'm putting a tablespoon of butter in. There is not much, just a tiny bit of fat, a tiny bit of salt. It doesn't need much salt. What you do need is time, because when you make grits, I bring the milk up to when I think it's about to simmer. I whisk in the grits and add the salt and the a tiny bit of butter, and you have to stay on that pot. You have to be in a heavy-bottomed stainless steel pot. You cannot be in aluminum because of the acid in the milk.
It's exactly the same as making polenta.
Exactly. And you have to stir. You have to stay on the bottom of that pot. You have to be on low heat. And the more you stir that, the better they are. And it takes about 40 minutes, almost exactly 40 minutes, good cooking to cook stone ground, real traditional grits.
But then they're holdable.
Oh, yeah. They're super holdable. You can hold them on the back of the stove. You can make them the day before and heat them up and serve them the next day, which is nice, especially if you are having family or some sort of party or gathering or something and you want to serve grits. And you can do a lot of stuff to grits. You can either serve them that way. You can add cheese to them. You can serve them with shrimp and butter. You can serve them with, I mean, it's a starch. You can do all kinds of stuff. But traditionally in the South, it would just be butter. There would never be anything sweet in there. No Southerner would make their grits sweet.
Cheese?
A good cheddar.
There are people that make grits with cheese sometimes.
Yeah. So,
do you like that?
I don't particularly. I really like grits. I love the flavor.
I want to taste the corn.
Grits.
I want
exactly.
to taste the corn.
You know, I mean, it's kind of fun if you have kids, I think, especially to put a little cheese in the grits. But I love the way grits taste too much. And then one of the other things I do with grits is I then make grit cakes. So that's super fun. There's the two things you can do. There's lots of things you can do. But the one thing that really is good is if you've got grits left over from the day before and they were just straight grits with the salt and the butter and the milk, and they're cold. So you take them out. And they're going to be cold on your hands. We make big batches, and I always feel like my hands are about to freeze when I make grit cakes. But we add a little bit of panko to them, a little bit of Reggiano cheese, and pepper.
Panko are the Japanese breadcrumbs, very light.
Yeah, and you want to add just the smallest amount of, you want the cheese just for taste. So obviously, once you like the way it tastes, then stop adding the cheese. Breadcrumb is just to hold it together. And if you make them too dense, they're just like hockey pucks. So you want to add just a little bit of panko, and you can test a couple, which is kind of fun, although they will explode on you. So that's not fun. So, you know, again, I work in a restaurant kitchen where my fryer is about at hip high and not in my face, which is where your fryer is on your stove. If you've got a pot on your stove with any kind of depth, you're really pretty close to your face or to your chest. So you really need to be conscious of what you're doing.
So tip from Cindy Wolf, keep your face away from the fryer.
Well, yeah, just give yourself as much distance as possible. But when you go to gently place that grit cake, which I form, it kind of looks like a hockey puck, and I form it in between my fingers, put together flat on top, flat on bottom, just gently immerse it in fat at 350 degrees. I suggest corn oil or peanut oil.
Don't just drop it in there.
Yeah, gently place it in there, back away, and make sure that it's not sort of starting to break up. Because if it starts to break up, you should have like a skimmer ready. Get it out of there right away because it's going to mess up your fat and it will
start shooting stuff
shooting
out
things
there.
At yeah. you. Yes. So, you know, maybe I shouldn't suggest that, but they're awfully good. So that's why.
So go back to the first recipe and just make the grits.
Creamy grits. All right.
Drop a poached egg on it or
so good.
A little, you know, chop up a little crispy bacon, a little green onion. That's pretty good.
Well, and the other thing with polenta, if you're making, I make creamy polenta. Also, they grind polenta for me, well, for anyone that wants it, from Anson's Mill as well. And that product is also incredible. I mean,
polenta, they're amazing.
It's because their corn is so good.
Too.
Yeah. But that's another one that I fry.
You just don't stop frying stuff, do you? When we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, we're going to talk about things that Cindy doesn't fry. All of that and more on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
We're talking about breakfast. You had started to talk about polenta. If you've missed some of this, you can go back to the WIPR.org website and find this episode on the Foreman and Wolf page or any number of others. And Cindy's got a few good recipes early on in the program. So what do you have to say about polenta,
Cindy? With polenta, you can make it with cream or with water or even a little bit of light stock. So it's really up to you what flavor, what you're serving it with. But again, it's another, you know, obviously it's dried corn. So it's another vessel for, you know, to serve with other fun things. And We do the same ratio as we do with grits. It's 4-to-1. And so a quarter cream, a cup of polenta. Now, I will say that when you use cream, that you will probably have to add some water as you are, as you're working them. So have some, a little water.
You can use milk too.
Yeah. Have a little bit set on the side, ready to go as it thickens up too much. And again, it's a slow and low, you know, long process, 40 minutes. You really want to cook those starch granules, and you want it to be tender on your tongue. You know, when you taste it, it shouldn't be bitey. And so that's fun. And if you do it with water, you can make crispy polenta the next day. And that's what I had started to talk about. So when you have leftover, you can't fry polenta that you made with cream, but you can fry polenta that you made with water. And we just cut it into long pieces and don't do anything else to it. It's cold. It goes right into the fryer. And oh my goodness, fried polenta is seriously fun. The name of the book that I'm referencing by Edna Lewis is called In Pursuit of Flavor, and I believe it was published in 1988. Another fun thing about Edna Lewis's book, and I was happy to see it because, again, this is a smaller recipe. She has a recipe for pork sausage, and it's a super simple recipe, but it's just good for people to know the ratio, which is 3 pounds, a mixture of pork loin and pork shoulder. So 3 pounds of a mixture of those two things, and then 3 pounds of unsalted bacon, which what unsalted bacon is pork belly, fresh pork belly. And that's the fat you need to make a good sausage, is from that pork belly. Now, with pork belly...
So you grind all that together.
Yeah, and I will tell you right now, one of the key things to making sausage or a pâté or a terrine is you have to emulsify the fat in. And when you're grinding, the action of grinding the meat creates friction, which creates heat in the grinder. So your meat has to be all, not frozen, but it needs to be... I put mine in the freezer for probably about 30 minutes before I grind it. And my grinding attachments, which mine are all metal, I don't know what you may have at home, but all my grinding attachments, every single part goes in the freezer or the walk-in or the refrigerator before, right? I mean, I don't bring anything out until I'm ready to go. So I do all my prep. I cut my meat into small pieces that I know will go through the grinder. You don't cut it into tiny, tiny pieces, but in like the 1-inch cubes or whatever. And it just depends. I don't, you know, you know what your grinder size is. Mine is pretty big because it's commercial. And then grind and alternate between meat and fat, meat and fat, meat and fat. And then the moment it's ready, you mix it together and then you put it right back. And you can always test your sausage or your meat for a terrine or a pâté. I mean, you're doing the same thing when... making sausage is just almost like making
a force meat. Yeah.
Yeah, you're making the same thing that you make to make those things. So that's why I keep saying that. You can always, well, you need to test it. So just put a saute pan on with a little bit of fat, get it hot, patty up a little bit of that sausage meat terrine or pate meat, patty it up, cook it, taste it, make sure it's seasoned properly. And I would add salt and pepper. I like to add a little bit of cayenne to mine. And from there, it's up to you. You could add sage, you could add thyme, you could add a tiny, tiny bit of rosemary, but it's up to you what flavor you want. But that's a basic pork sausage recipe. What do you like to make for breakfast, Tony?
The polenta thing triggers two really big memories for me. And, I mean, I described in the last segment the one polenta dish with a poached egg and all the vegetables, and I love that. But I will admit the polenta makes me think first of this rabbit dish from Italy years ago, where the rabbits were roasted over a wood fire and then cooled off and then picked.
Yes.
And
yummy.
The pan for the polenta, mushrooms are browned in garlic in there for a while, and then everything comes out. And then the polenta is cooked in that pan. And then the rabbit and the mushrooms go into another heavy pan, all that picked meat to become a fricassea, you know, slowly crispy.
Yeah.
A little fatty, the mushroom and garlic flavor, it mixes nicely with the rabbit. And you literally, it's just the polenta and some of that, you know, that really nice creamy polenta, and then some of the rabbit fricassea with the mushrooms.
Gosh,
and the garlic.
I love rabbit.
Now, I would definitely eat that for breakfast.
I would too.
But I don't think
happily
of that as principally as a breakfast dish.
Well, true. That could be a good Sunday night dinner. Is what that could be.
That could be at any time you want to be.
Or
happy
an appetizer. Well, you can make it an appetizer. Really, really.
No, you want too much of it. I mean, it could be. that's the thing about a dish that's that satisfying. It's very hard.
Okay.
It's very hard to make it as a first dish. First dish, I mean, an Italian menu rhythm I like the most, and it's, you know, that first something, the antipasti, is something that teases, it entices, it excites, it has snap, it has freshness, it has a strong flavor that wakes up your palate, that makes you want the pasta, the polenta, the risotto, the you know, the rich soup, the bean dish, the whatever that primo literally means, the first real dish. Antipasti is purely tease and sort of social time, you know. And then secondo is, okay, now I've had that starch, that first real dish. Let me have some meat. Let me have a fish.
Right.
I like that rhythm a lot, and you couldn't have that polenta dish antipasti, you'd be dead.
Right.
Speaking of dead.
All right, let's have it done.
It's probably time for you to enjoy the chef's challenge. And my handwriting is pristine this time.
Okay, so eggs, Parmigiano, fresh milled polenta, basil, something summer tomatoes.
Oh, my God.
Prosciutto.
Put up summer
put
tomatoes.
Put up. Oh, well, is that... Yeah, anyway. Prosciutto.
It's a technical term.
I was going to say, what is put up? Is that, like, words?
Preserved. Preserved. Put up in your cellar.
Prosciutto di Parma, salami calabrese, dates, fresh dates. Black Tuscan kale, fresh ricotta, sheep's milk. Oh, I love that. Chilies, your choice. Durum flour, mirepoix, spice cabinet, dairy, extra virgin olive oil. Okay. So
what are you making for breakfast?
Oh, I can't wait to make it. The salami calabrese.
Calabrese, yeah.
Thank you, prosciutto.
You just go right to the pork products, don't you?
You know I do. Well, that's kind of, I kind of just want to eat that. So I really think that...
like really garlicky sausage first thing in the morning?
Oh my golly, yeah.
That's why you have to have breakfast wine.
Okay, so I'm going to julienne a little bit of the prosciutto and slice the salami. And I'm going to make scrambled eggs. And I'll finish it with the Parmigiano. Meanwhile, I'm actually also going to make the polenta, just like I already said, which would be with the cream and a tiny bit of salt and pepper, and finish the polenta also with just a little bit of the Parmigiano. And I'm going to lay basil leaves on top of that polenta once it's finished, and then put up summer tomatoes. I'll heat those up, roast them a little bit in the oven, and if they're not too big, I don't know what size they are, chop them a little bit.
You can cut them, yeah.
Uh-huh, chop them, and then put those with the polenta, because the polenta with the Parmigiano and the basil and the tomatoes would be great, and then the scrambled eggs with the prosciutto and the salami calabrese, and what am I going to do with kale? I'm not doing anything with kale. All right, so the kale, I will, to use everything, unlike Tony when he does his chef's challenges, I will julienne the Tuscan kale and add that to the eggs at the end, which I would never do, just so you know.
Then don't do it. Just take the kale and throw it over your shoulder. That's what you would do.
The dates I would absolutely just lay out, because I love dates, and I would have those laid out. Actually, I would lay those out with a little bit of prosciutto just so that they're there, and if people want to have something to eat while you're cooking, there's something to snack on. The durum flour, why'd you give me mirepoix? I'm trying to figure out what I was supposed to do with mirepoix for breakfast. The durum flour. What, am I making pasta?
You could have.
I guess.
You could have made it and filled it with a ricotta and some of the mirepoix and the kale.
This is Tony's chef challenge.
Yeah. I did that recently. It was lovely.
We cook very differently, Tony. The fresh ricotta I would also put out because with the dates, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. I will never forget going to Italy. Was it Sicily or Sardinia? Where were we when that man kept making that fresh ricotta? I can't remember these things.
In Puglia.
Oh my gosh, we had ricotta that they'd made that morning. We'd had ricotta that was made the day before and ricotta that was from the beginning of the week. All on the same table. I will never forget how unbelievably good those, and
Masseria.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so good. Puglia. That's my chef's challenge. Your turn, Tony. Here you go.
Okay.
All right.
Cornmeal, AP flour, eggs, country ham, ground pork, bacon.
You want to make sure you have pork products.
Four pork products. Lard, brown sugar, baking powder, sugar, butter, brioche, pecans, hazelnuts, and walnuts.
You can tell that we each wrote our chef challenges for ourselves.
Onion, shallot, garlic. See, we should just hand them and then hand them back.
Right.
Onion, shallot, garlic, peach preserves. Okay. I've got the goods here to make cornmeal pancakes with cornmeal and mixed with the AP flour, and you have baking powder and sugar and this. Well, you need oil. Oil to cook it in, a little bit of oil for
and you
the,
can have milk. You can have milk.
But it'd be nice to have those pancakes. Make them not too sweet because I'd like to hit them with the peach preserves when they come out.
See, and I would hit it with the brown sugar and butter too.
I understand.
You know it. You know it.
No, I would make them, like I said, light on sugar and hit them with the peach preserves and a little butter. Let's see, what other sort of fun is there here to be had? The ground pork I would like to season and also add a little bit of the bacon to get the bacon crispy and stuff the poblanos with that and some onion and some garlic and roast those guys. Were I to have cheese that melted like fresh mozzarella or
you
something
don't.
Like that.
You
no,
don't have that.
I don't.
No.
I still like to have the roasted stuffed pepper. So those guys have pretty good juice. What else to play with? The brioche, easy enough to make French toast with the brioche.
Makes the best French toast. I love that.
The pecans and the walnuts you can keep. The hazelnuts.
Yeah, it was kind of or. Yeah, I meant to say or. Just
yeah, the hazelnuts I love, and I'd want to toast those guys and make the French toast with crispy pieces of the country ham. Layer them in between and make almost like a toasted hazelnut butter to dress the whole bit of business. But the hazelnuts are a little bit bitter. And the brioche, you can put a little bit of the brown sugar in the batter for that guy. And that'd be good. The lard, I could have cooked the poblanos in the lard. What else? I think I used most of your business. I didn't use your shallot. You can have a shallot back.
Okay, thanks. I'll put it with that durum wheat and the mirepoix.
Just in case you wanted to make pasta.
I can give you a cornmeal pancake recipe very quickly.
Yeah, why don't you do that?
With any pastry, you have to, have a recipe, half a cup plus 2 tablespoons of all-purpose flour, half a cup of cornmeal. So that's a good ratio. I like that a lot. 3/4 teaspoon of sugar, a pinch of salt, 1 teaspoon of baking powder, 1 egg beaten, 3/4 cup of milk, and 3 tablespoons of melted butter, which is super important to that batter. And just mix it all together. Just don't overwork it, and easily done. And you can make it the day before. Sometimes you just thin it out with it. If you make it the day before, and also, well, I will say one thing, 3/4 cup of milk, I would use buttermilk instead of the milk. So that would be the one difference I would make to that recipe, but you can go either way. So again, it's not always easy to find buttermilk, so it's nice to have a recipe that has milk in it.
Tell people why the buttermilk.
I love the flavor, the acidity of the buttermilk.
It's for the acid.
Yeah, it just gives balance to the recipe, and I love and I'll tell you the reason why for the cornmeal. I like that texture. It's just a much more interesting pancake, and but not what you think of traditionally. So.
And you can get them pretty fluffy.
Mm-hmm.
I also I like buckwheat pancakes very much, although they're heavier for sure.
Mm-hmm.
They're
not as easy to make either. Yeah, buckwheat, they may not, they cannot rise sometimes, but the flavor is really good.
Yeah, flavor is really, really good.
Yeah. Yeah, we were talking about Belgian waffles the other day. I was talking to my niece about it, and we were talking about how much we love those. And I'd like to find a good recipe for Belgian waffles. So I have one of those makers at home. I've never used it. But the smell of those
kitchen
things.
Equipment you've never used?
I know, it's so weird. Well, it's at my house. Yeah, it's the smell of Belgian waffles versus regular waffles. And the other thing, and I said I wasn't going to talk about anything French, but I do love crepes. Crepes, oof, love crepes. Crepes, again, it's another
I knew you would
foil,
never make it.
No, foil for
I knew
so
you
many.
Would never make it. You almost made it because you're out of time.
All right.
So if you want to listen to this or any other episode, or I should say podcast, of Former Wolf on Food and Wine, go to the WYPR website, WYPR.org, look up the Foreman Wolf page, and you can find all the episodes there. If you want to correspond with us and tell us what you're thinking, ask a recipe or a travel tip or wine information, or want to share any of your favorite breakfast recipes, it's ForemanWolf@WYPR.org. And if you'd like to follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media,
you can follow me on Twitter as Chef Cindy Wolf and on Instagram as Chef Wolf.
And I am the real Tony Foreman.
Versus
on
any
Instagram.
Fake ones out there.
At least
any
on
wannabes?
Instagram.
Yeah. All right.
Oh, there's so many pretenders. Anyway, thanks so much for listening today.
And happy Sunday.